Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome to Jewel Says. I have a special guest today. His name is J.P. Castlin, and I met him online, I'm saying quote-unquote met him, years ago when I read his very articulate essay about comedy and perspective at a time when Catherine was receiving an onslaught of violent threats from people who had just clearly misunderstood a joke. She seems to let these things roll off her, but it is a little more difficult for me, you know? I could probably take it if it were directed at me better than one of my children. But I have followed JP ever since. And this year in March, JP honored me by asking me to take over his Twitter feed on International Women's Day. JP works as an independent strategic management consultant. He's a highly acclaimed writer, speaker. He's a lawyer, a marketing and brand strategist. But more important than his long list of professional credentials, he is a fascinating, thoughtful, caring human being who generously offered to record an informal little chat with me, Jules, for my fluffy little podcast. I hope you enjoy hearing JP's perspectives as much as I enjoyed our chat. I could have continued for hours, but JP is a busy man in demand, and I had to get to work myself. Without further ado, JP Castlin. Welcome to Jewel Says, JP. I'm really honored that you're willing to come on this podcast. I follow some of your stuff, and it's a little too cerebral for old Jules, but I appreciate that you're willing to come on here and talk about sort of light life stuff. So thank you.
Well, it's my absolute pleasure. And I think the life stuff is no less cerebral or important than anything else. So, you know, happy to do it.
Well, it is important. I mean, after all, that's really the thing that matters. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Anything you'd like to share?
Anything I'd like to share? Well, I mean, the long and the short of it is a former lawyer working in merger and acquisitions, who then moved into strategy, business strategy, marketing strategy, and a whole lot of writing and speaking and things like that. So I'm both sort of a marketer and a lawyer, which usually puts me in part with the devil in most people's eyes. And then I've added sort of management consulting on top of that. So, you know, most people, I think, would consider me to be pure evil at this stage, but, you know, that's fine. But yeah, that's me in a nutshell, I suppose.
Well, all the lawyers, what's the Shakespearean saying? The lawyers, I forget, I actually have a magnet on my magnet board. The lawyers, let them burn in hell or something. I have to look it up because now that's irritating me because I should know it.
But, no, I mean, the thing about lawyers is the more lawyers there are, the more problems there will be, the more lawyers there will be required and so on and so forth. So lawyers are kind of like viruses in that sense. You know, but certain kinds of lawyers, I always think that it's kind of like there's a saying in advertising that everybody hates advertising until they lose their cat, right? At which point you put up the poster. And it's similar with lawyers, is that like people hate lawyers until they need one, at which point you need a really good one, or you want a really good one anyway. And that's kind of what it is with the legal field, from my experience. Of course, there are a lot of dickheads in law, but there are dickheads in all kinds of fields. So, you know.
But I think you usually don't need a lawyer until you have an argument to manage. And I think that's really the crux of it. People have difficulty with the argument. And then there's a lawyer on the other side, sometimes doing an excellent job of advocating for your adversary. So I think that's partly why people are uncomfortable with the legal profession. The only time I've ever dealt with a lawyer was through my divorce. And it was like a knife twisting in my gut every time I had to have a letter or a conversation or anything. And so context is everything. Maybe mergers and acquisitions aren't quite so adversarial as family law, or at least emotionally adversarial.
Well, yeah, I mean, from my experience, and I've done some family law, whenever there's money involved, people tend to show their ugliest sides. I've literally had a divorce case, and this is while I was still sort of studying, really, but we were helping out, basically. And the man and the previous wife, so to speak, they were arguing over things like just small containers of spices and just like stuff that would cost you a dollar at most. And again, as soon as there's money involved, I mean, in terms of mergers and acquisitions, there's usually just a lot of money involved. You do deals that are, you know, in the billions of dollars. So people tend to get quite stressed. But the other thing as well, interestingly enough, when you do those kinds of numbers is that they tend to become quite abstract. And I think that's a good thing, because if you're dealing with those kinds of big numbers, then, you know, if you actually understand how much money it is, then I think most people would collapse under the pressure. But again, no, I think you're right. I mean, family law is such a, whenever there's kids involved and, you know, feelings and that kind of thing, it's everything becomes very infected very quickly, unfortunately. But, you know, it is what it is. The best use of a lawyer, I always say, is have the lawyer before you have to have the divorce, or you have the disagreement of whatever it is. Drop all the contracts when you're friends, you know, if possible. That's basically the best use of a lawyer. Then sometimes you won't even have to use a lawyer for the second bit.
Well, that makes sense. But I feel like if you're friends, you're probably not going to get a divorce. But I digress. We didn't ask you on here to talk about divorce. And your specialty in the legal area was mergers and acquisitions, it sounds like.
Yes. So, yeah, corporate finance, basically. And then from that as well into what is called corporate governance, which is essentially running boards for companies. But then that kind of led me into strategy. And it was in strategy that I find my, to use a cliche, but it's sort of my calling. And so that's what I've done ever since.
I was going to ask you how you transitioned and what motivated you to transition.
It was a really dull story, really. It was where I was working, and this is often the case for these kinds of companies. It's the same for finance and corporate finance, in other words, the legal field from my experience, which is that companies will hire what they call insecure overachievers, by which they mean people who have top grades, but because they have top grades, they don't have a lot of friends. And then they sort of, you know, they employ them and they burn them out subsequently in about, I don't know, 2 years. I think average tenure at our company was something like six months to a year, I think. And then people were just burned out. And the sort of the select few that actually make it through this, you know, hell, then eventually over time, you'll earn a bit more and then you earn a bit more. And then come year five, you get another zero on your salary. And I was at year four and a half, I think it was. And it was clear that I was sort of coming up to that level where they would have to add a zero. But this was during the financial crisis, 2008. So they wanted to keep me, but they didn't want to pay me necessarily.
Tale as old as time.
Yeah, exactly right. And so what happened was I basically went, okay, so I'm just going to look elsewhere. But the problem is that you don't necessarily quit at those kinds of companies. You get fired, right? And so the company CEO, he just went, okay, we'll allow you to leave, but we will not provide any references at all. Now, that's the equivalent of not just performing poorly, but it's like you were never there. And so subsequently, when I looked at other jobs, I would get to the point where they would call the firm, and then that was it. So I was kind of forced to actually sort of come up with something myself. And that's what eventually led me to switching to a sort of a tangential field, but not necessarily the same thing. And that, again, that led me to strategy. And the thing about that as well is that in corporate language, you know, you see this term all the time, pivoting, right? Mm-hmm. You pivot.
Yeah.
What is often lost in the context is that whenever you pivot into a context where all your new competitors already know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And when I quote unquote pivoted into strategy, I basically had to outperform everyone. And this, because at every single gig I got, if there was someone there that I knew, they just went, well, what are you doing here? You're a lawyer. Right.
Yeah.
And then you just go, okay. So that in turn forced me to start all the other stuff, the writing and the talking and the blah, 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 in order to just prove myself. And then over time, it turned out I was quite good at that as well. But I mean, writing I've done since I wrote my first quote unquote professional article when I was 14. So I've done that for a fair few years.
I think you're a very good writer. You first came to my attention when you wrote a piece after my daughter Catherine was getting death threats over a misunderstood joke.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you still have it or if you can find it, but I haven't been able to find it. And I...
No, I mean, it might be on one of my old computers. I'll give it a look. But I was trying to find it this morning. I couldn't find it. But that actually came during that sort of transition phase, if you want to call it that, because I was... The reason why I was doing a lot of... I was writing stand-up for British comedians. I was doing stand-up myself in order to... I just do it for practice, basically, for my other speaking stuff. But so I was sitting at Law Firm Board, and I was writing all this stuff. And then I saw the original joke with Catherine. I saw the reaction. And I just wrote a reply saying... basically explaining how jokes work and how this joke was constructed. Actually, her point was the exact opposite of what some people took from it.
Yeah.
And it was funny to see the reactions, because I think I got 5 death threats myself as well. I didn't really care too much, but it was just odd.
Wow. Well, all I remember is how beautifully articulated it was. And that's what made me go, oh, who is this person? So then I started following you, and then I saw changes over time. And you've had some life changes since then as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you go through life, and then obviously now I'm married and have a daughter, and it's one of those things as well. I mean, it's such a, again, a cliche, but about a month ago or so, it was -5-ish centigrade outside, no clouds, sun is out, it's just perfect day, winter day, basically. And it was Saturday morning, and I was working. And because I needed to finish a presentation for a thing. And my wife just went, oh, well, I'll take our daughter outside and go play so you can work in peace. And I worked for about 5 minutes. And then I thought, actually, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go out and play with them in the snow instead. And it was literally one of the best mornings of my life, right? And trying to identify what really matters in life is actually one of those things that you do far too late, I think.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And which is why I'm having this thing. I've just come up with this idea. It's probably stupid, but for my family, I'm having for sort of the larger family, I'm having every family member over the age of 60 write down their sort of the life lessons on a page in a book. And then as soon as someone turns 60, they can add to their page. And basically you have that as sort of a thing for all the family to read. Because again, it's when you read it, it's like, of course, that's what matters in life, right? But it's saying it and experiencing it are two different things. And again, a lot of these things you experience way too late in your life, unfortunately.
That's true. That's kind of what my podcast is. Life lessons and regrets, really.
Yeah.
When you think about it in a nutshell. Because I do have a lot of regrets. And I mean, I know people say, well, you can't have regrets. Whatever you did brought you here. But I have quite a few. And it isn't an issue. My whole point of sharing it is I would really love for people to figure these things out sooner so that they don't get to 60 and have a super long list. I mean, even with boundaries at work, I did learn to set boundaries at work because there were specific reasons where I thought that I was being persistently taken advantage of. And one of the things I say is, well, I've never heard of anyone on their deathbed saying, I wish I spent more time at the office.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's very true. I think as well as not taking a lot of crap from people or unnecessarily crap. I have a friend, and I haven't really spoken about this too much publicly because I think it's her story more so than mine. In fact, my wife didn't know about it. My parents didn't know about this until this person mentioned it in her talk at her wedding. But I have a friend who she used to work in, she still works in construction and real estate, but she used to work at this company, and they had one of those team building affairs, right? And it was basically her boss, her, a couple of other middle management types, and a chef, right? So there was this cooking class, and it was designed to be team building, whatever else. And her boss started groping her. And of course, because they were all male, the other people, no one said, you know, anything. And she left the room, and he followed her and pushed her up against the wall. And she came back into the room crying. And at which point the chef, not anyone else at her company, but the chef spoke up and was just like, what the hell's happening here? Anyway, and so she called me on the way back home and crying. And I was just like, oh, okay, well, I'll send your CEO an email. An email basically saying, yeah, if you don't sort this shit out, I'm going to sue the hell out of you. And what apparently happened was that the very next day, the CEO called the guy in so that the entire company could hear it. Let's put it that way. Just shouted obscenities at him, had him apologize in front of the entire organization, and then fired him.
And oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's one of those things, you know, talk about not taking crap. I mean, she doesn't take crap now, but also it's like actually sort of standing up for yourself. Because a lot of people just go, well, you know, it's bad and you have to do this because otherwise I won't get a promotion or whatever else. But, you know, life's kind of too short.
Well, and you advocated for her. I think it's very important for women in these positions to have men advocating. Because this isn't a woman's problem. This is a human problem.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And there's also, I was talking to a friend of mine when I wrote an article about sort of, I suppose, women in the working place. That's such a cliche as well. But how one treats women, equality, and so on. It had to do with the fact that, so as a very quick off piece, just to sort of demonstrate where I'm coming from, my grandmother on my mom's side was one of the first strong feminists in Sweden. And so, and my mom is one of those people who, one of those women who could silence an entire football stadium with just one look, right? And so Kamala Harris was the first female and also black vice president in the US. And that's what everyone was talking about. My mom just like, yes, aren't we past that point? Why does it matter if she's a woman or that she's black? She's a vice president, you know. We shouldn't be concerned about those things because it should be just natural anyway. And anyway, so I wrote a piece about that, and I was talking to this friend of mine, and she made a really important point that I wish that because I still struggle with it myself. I think a lot of men do, but there's a difference between speaking up for someone and speaking over them, right? And so with my friend, for example, I basically told him, okay, so this is what I'm going to do, and then she was fine with it, but. Again, when you're sort of standing up for your sort of fellow women, you have to do it on their terms, not yours, if that makes sense, I think.
I think it does.
Because again, yeah, because otherwise there's a lot of white knighting and sort of, yes, of course, the weak sex, I have to stand up for her. Otherwise, you know, and that's kind of not the point. In fact, I'd say it's the opposite of the point.
But I do think part of the point is we still have, and maybe things are better in Sweden. We all think that things in Sweden are better than they are in North America. But I do think that very often when you have a company of men with men in charge, they will only respect when the man speaks up. That's part of the problem. So for a woman to speak up, it might be like, I don't know. Let's play that friend scenario out. If she had just gone to the CEO, who knows? Like how many women have gone to a leader or HR or a CEO telling them about something like that, and it just gets brushed under the rug or ignored. So having a lawyer write a very pointed letter or an email, I think makes a difference. And I think very often men just respect hearing from men more than they do from women. So I feel like that's, even though you're right, you have to advocate on the woman's terms, we still need men to advocate. We can't just do it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too. The one caveat I do have is after I'd written that piece about Kamala Harris, and it wasn't about her, it was again about inclusivity and diversity. And is there's a beyond all the sort of the quote unquote gender arguments, there's a real commercial reason why you want to increase diversity in a company, just based on pure mathematics and commercial aspects. But anyway, but I wrote the thing and I said to my friend who works a lot in these sort of circuits, and I said, all right, so I'm happy to essentially do a talk for free or, you know, anything like that. If you have a conference and you want me to speak in front of other senior men, basically, because they might listen to me. And she said, okay, well, that's interesting. Yeah, that sounds great. Here's this person you want to speak to. Okay, so this person I apparently need to speak to, well, some sort of inclusivity, whatever. I send her an email saying, okay, so this is what I've done and sort of this is my history and this is what I'd like to speak about. You know, if you at some point have an open spot at a conference, and I'm usually quite expensive as a speaker, but I'll do it for free, right? I didn't mention the expensive bit to her, obviously, but just for reference.
Yeah.
And her reply was, by offering to do this for free, you have robbed a minority of the opportunity to offer to do it for free. In other words, fuck off. And at which point I just went, okay. And then I reached out to another guy who was he was running conferences in Europe. And this is a guy. And I said, okay, so same story, and I'll do this for free. And he replied with, no, this is my field. Stop stepping on my toes.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, if that's the level we're at the moment, I just go, okay, so then I just, you know, I'll continue to support every woman that I know in my life and so on, you know, everything that they need. But if it's that kind of reaction whenever you're offering to help, then that at some point you just go, okay, so screw it. I'll just focus on the stuff.
Exactly.
On some other stuff. It's just weird.
I mean, fuck that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But supporting individuals, I think, matters anyway.
Yeah.
That's really upset because I think that's one of the reasons, people complain about the left and they complain about quote unquote wokeism. Now, I don't know of anyone who is self-proclaimed as woke.
Yeah.
And I think the term has kind of been hijacked. But then when you have someone who's in charge of inclusivity and they're actually just denying an opportunity for someone to, I don't know.
Yeah. There's interesting. Have you ever happened to have seen the show on HBO called The Last of Us?
No.
You should see, it's a masterpiece. It's one of the best dramas to come out in ages and ages and ages. It's based on a video game that is also rather good. But anyway, so I won't spoil anything for any of your listeners who haven't seen it, but I recommend it very highly. And so there was in the sort of this third episode, right? All of the episode follows a man and essentially a teenage girl as they're sort of traversing through a post-apocalyptic zombie landscape, basically. And the third episode, they feature for maybe 5 minutes total in the entire episode. And the rest of the episode is sort of a standalone story about these two middle-aged, too old, because it goes over time, gay men.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the best love stories you'll ever see, right? And what's been really interesting has been the reaction, which is that when this sort of, if you look at people tweeting live and sort of also reviewing it, you see that when the show starts, you're introduced to these two gay people, gay men, and they start kissing and then they have sex. And then it's all, this is HBO trying to force wokeism in our throat, blah, 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 blah. And then what happened in the episode was as it moved on, it was such a beautiful love story. These people came around and it just went, well, actually, this was an amazing love story. And that's why it's sort of, if you look at, obviously you still have some homophobic people, which is why if you look at the score, the IMDb score for that episode, I think it's something like 9.8. And it's because there are, from all the reviewers and all the people there, it's just tens. And then it was review bombed with a bunch of zeros from homophobics. So it's only tens and zeros, which is quite funny. But it's kind of the same thing. If we take woke and reduce it into these cliches and platitudes, you know, of course it's going to be horseshit because you can't reduce a human being into any one thing or two things anyway. But it has been hijacked. It has been, it's sort of seen as all that is wrong with the world by the conservatives who want to go back to the sort of family values of the 1930s. You know,
I think it would
time,
have been horrible to be a woman in the 1930s.
Oh, no. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, but at the same time, you know, there is sometimes there is, of course, as well, the part of that movement, which is that you get, quote unquote, new feminists who think that feminism was something that started when you began burning your bras in the 70s. You know,
yeah.
And no real understanding of your history. But as long as they're coming from a right place, you know. Who gives a shit?
Exactly.
I don't. Yeah, you know, whatever makes people happy, anyway. But you know.
Yeah.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I have said to you, I would say you're a feminist. Do you hate that term?
No, I don't hate it. I mean, I think it's a much more loaded term in the US or in North America. I don't label myself a feminist. I don't think my mom does either. But it's just, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's just about treating people well and being kind to people and understanding that, you know, just there's no such thing as a weaker sex, or, you know, it's just treat women the way that you would treat men and you'll be fine. It's not that difficult. It's just don't be an asshole. And the problem that I see with my American friends, and this is American more so than Canadian, because I think Canada is a lot close to Scandinavia in terms of how the people are and the values and so on. At least it has been whenever I've been to Canada, is that it's still very much a sort of, you know, the man is bringing in home the money, the woman is staying at home with the kids. And when it seems to me like whenever a woman in the US meets someone, her friends will ask her, well, what does he do for a living? Mm-hmm. Which is the wrong question. The question you should ask is, does he make you happy? Mm-hmm. That's it, right? And some of that may have to do with a lack of class system historically and blah, 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 blah. Hence, you'd sort of tie class to money, but that's a different argument. But, you know, same thing there. When you are taking that sort of passive role of actually, I'm going to rely on you, then implicitly, I think perhaps you are sort of portraying that weaker sex in a sense. Not to say that there's anything wrong with being a housewife, absolutely not, but you kind of get my point. You know, if that's what you're looking for in life, is to find someone to be able to support you, then I think you're going to have a problem, you know, not least if you have a divorce.
Oh, I think it's hugely risky. I would be terrified to be financially dependent on someone, and I never have been. But I also think, what a gift to the family, even if you take a few years and sacrifice your career trajectory to look after hearth and home and children. What a gift.
Yeah.
When I was raising my children and working, I used to sometimes think, man, I wish I had a wife. There's just too much for one person to do. So I think it's a gift, but it's certainly not a risk I would be willing to take. No way.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I saw I think it was the latest stand-up special with Chris Rock, where he said about romance and relationships in general, and said, it's not really that hard. It's just that it takes two people to lift a couch. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the point, right? You know, however you do that, as long as you're contributing, then that's fine.
Exactly.
At the same time, you know, the problem, of course, is that and Americans work a lot anyway, but if you have a man who's now the sole provider for the family, you know, it tends to follow that he will prioritize work over family because he has to bring in the money and whatever else. And that's not necessarily good for your family. In fact, I can't mention any names, but I know of one case in Sweden where the father was and the husband was so successful. He's very, very successful and built an extremely successful company that he was basically never there for his daughter, so much so that she eventually ended up in a psychiatric ward because he was always sort of somewhere else. And then you go, okay, so you're providing for your family, but not really, because the fact that you're gone so much, it means that, you know, they just suffer. And that's the thing as well. Like money, although money's nice, money's not everything. There are a lot more important things in life. And again, I come back to just, you know, the fact that I was able to go out and play in the snow with my daughter and my wife. It was just, yeah. You know.
I mean, as long as you have enough.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, again, with sort of reference, this is coming from an ex-lawyer working in corporate finance, and now a management consultant. Like, I like money, but don't get me wrong. You know, like nice cars and nice watches and those kinds of things, the luxuries in life. But there's nothing that is as luxurious as being able to spend time with your family. That's just the fact, you know.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah. I like money too. The comfort of not having to worry about it.
Yeah.
I also like knowing that I don't have to rely on someone else. But the other problem with relying on someone for the money is very often the relationship dynamic evolves into, because I earn the money, I'm the one in charge and it's my money. And that's the other risk. So that's the other reason I would never want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it kind of alludes to. And I said, you know, the sort of the week or six thing, that's basically it. You know, you get a power asymmetry within the relationship because the man or the woman, I mean, it doesn't have to be the man who's providing the money. It could be where else. But the part who provides all the money, they do have that opportunity to just go, yeah, but I'm paying for everything here. So, you know, if you don't like it, ..
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it is what it is. But being able to not only stand up for yourself, I suppose, in terms of vocalizing displeasure, but also being able to stand up for yourself in terms of the just financially, I think is rather important. Again, so you not depend on anyone else.
Yeah, I think that's important too. Mm. And having fulfillment, because your career, I don't love my job, but I can say I took a 1 year hiatus mid-pandemic that turned into two.
Mm-hmm.
And what surprised me about that was I didn't realize how much my job was tied to my self-worth.
Yeah.
I felt like such a loser because I wasn't earning money, because I wasn't going to work. And like it or not, I've invested so many years in this career. This is what I'm good at. So for me to try and pivot, if you will, to something else, I mean, I did some audiobooks. I learned how to edit sound. I started the podcast. I did things like that. But all of a sudden, I'm doing something that I'm not good at, working very hard at things I'm not very good at and making no money. And it made me feel like a loser. So when I got an offer to go back to a contract, I took it. So I do have a contract again now. And they extended me and I'm just like, oh, it feels good to do something I'm actually good at again. But then there's a part of me that would like, I don't really want to do this anymore. You know, it's...
No, exactly. I mean, that's interestingly enough. I've been trying to for a couple of years set up basically an agency or a consultancy in the US, but based on Scandinavian values. And what I mean by that is, you know, equal pay and those kinds of things. Obviously, paid maternity leave, fully paid maternity leave, 6 weeks of vacation, all those kinds of things. And I sort of pitched this to a bunch of consultancy heads and agency heads, and they all said, yes, that sounds like a great idea, but we can't do it. And it was either because they didn't want to do it or because they tried things like, I know that advertising agencies, for example, some of them will offer, whenever you do a promotion or pay raise, they go, okay, so you can get your increase in wage, either just all money or some of it in money and some of it in extra vacation every time. And people always take all the money in the US. But in the UK and Europe, they just basically take the split. And I think, again, because in the US, class and self-worth is so tied to working hard and making money, it's kind of, you're almost sort of fooling yourself. I think as well, that's the other thing, you know, not to go into David Graeber and bullshit jobs and so on. But if you go back through history, if you go to the 30s, for example, look at what Hayek was talking about, a lot of the things that then people, economists, thought would become automated so we can all go down to three-hour weeks, but three-day weeks, right? a lot of those things have happened, but we're still working more than ever. And we're getting AIs and all these things that can be automated, and yet we're working more than ever. So why is that? And Graeber's hypothesis is that we're basically fooling ourselves. Because if you're working, doing something, whatever it is, and all of a sudden you can do the same thing in a third of the time, what it means is one of two things. Either you need to get a third of your salary, or the company can fire two-thirds of their employees, or at least the employees to do that thing. And so you basically have to fool yourself into thinking you're busy and being productive and you're working hard all the time. You know, otherwise, you know, you stand the risk of losing your employment. And so it's not just that, you know, our self-worth and the money and the work. It's just like we keep fooling ourselves that that's what we have to do. And you know, getting out of that is difficult, to say that, put it mildly.
And employers don't want to pay you full-time salary to do one-third of a, as they would see it, one-third
no,
of a job.
No, exactly.
I had a position once where I was able to cut back to an 80% work week when my children were all very little for a short period of time. And I covered for this guy. So I was supposed to be covering for a guy for a month who went off. He was the hardware communications person and I did the software support. And I said to my boss at the time, do you want me to book extra time off for these extra days I'm working? Or do you just want to pay me? And he said, well, you're not getting paid for the number of hours you work. You're getting paid to do a job. We're not going to pay you extra for that. And I went, wait. When I cut back to 80%, you cut my pay. It doesn't work one way and not the other. But he actually said that to me at the time. I work for a company with a head office in the U.S. It was in Pittsburgh. And whenever people were at the head office, it was interesting because as long as the bosses were at work, people would wander around, even though they were finished their work with nothing to do, just so that they could be seen.
Exactly. That's the thing. The key to the when it comes down to it, right? And it's again, you know, we're talking about cliches, but the question is, so how long do you have to work in a day? And the answer is 5 seconds longer than the guy working next to you. As soon as he leaves, then you can, or, you know, longer than your boss. And it's very much the case. And again, you know, these people could have done other things, but there's a, you know, not going to management too much, but there are things that, for example, if you work any kind of service, professional service, then what you tend to do is you tend to try to maximize your hours. In other words, the hours that you can charge a client, right? But actually, if you look at it, you should probably have a utility rate of somewhere around 70%. And then you should spend the last 30% of your time essentially improving your skills and reading stuff and coming up with new ideas, because that's how you get better as a professional. But again, people don't necessarily see it that way. There's a huge difference between efficiency and effectiveness. And unfortunately, a lot of companies are going all in on efficiency and misunderstanding the importance of effectiveness. And it's an old Peter Drucker quote, but there's nothing so useless as doing with great efficiency that which should not be done at all. And so that's, this is never getting into my daily work. And this is what I work with companies on and those kinds of matters. But there's also an interesting point there about pay, by the way. Sometimes people complain about management consultants and strategy consultants and so on charging a lot of money. And one is, if you can, then why shouldn't you, right? Mm-hmm. But also, too, like if I take one of my clients that I've worked with recently, obviously you're just a small part and there's a whole lot more happening and blah, 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 blah. But basically, my work led to them earning around $5 billion, right? I don't get a percentage of that, obviously, right? That would have been nice if I did, but don't. But if I cost X and I produce X times, you know, 50,000 or whatever it might be. I haven't done the math. Maybe I should. But, you know.
Negotiate a percentage of the...
Yeah.
Of the...
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that nothing is expensive if it's worth its money.
Exactly. And you could spend money on someone else who isn't effective and probably spend just as much. I mean, this is true in the IT world as well. You know, in IT consulting. I mean, some people just aren't necessarily creative thinkers and solution oriented. Yeah. They will execute a task that you give them. Whereas some of us will think, wait, here's a better way to do this. What are you trying to accomplish? And figure out a better way to do it.
There is in that, though, there's an interesting point to be made around different perspectives, which is this. If you're working on a project, you're not the project lead, you're just working on a project. And we've all had this experience. You know, I'm sure I have. I'm sure you have. I would guarantee all of your listeners have. We have this experience in which we come up with an idea that could improve whatever we're doing. And so we tell whoever's in charge of this project, we go, okay, so actually, if you do it like this, or if you do it like that, we'll have an idea. And then we're met by, no, but that wouldn't work. Or, mm-hmm. no, let's just stick to the plan. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. Basically, the idea gets shot down, right? And over time, we learn that actually, it's no real point in coming up with our own ideas. It's much better to just go, yes, Frank, that sounds brilliant, and do whatever it is that Frank wants us to do, even though it'll sort of make us throw up in our mouths a bit. But if you instead take the perspective and the viewpoint of whoever's in charge of this project, what are the things you're looking for as a product manager? You're looking to come in on time, ideally under budget, and a project that is as smooth as possible. That's what you're looking for. That's good management. Any new idea will disrupt that. And so on one end, you have the sort of the stick to the plan, let's keep things smooth. It comes out of strategic planning and by extension, you know, Fayola and Taylor. And then you have the people actually have new ideas and want to improve the status quo. And this is a huge problem for companies. In fact, there's a piece of research that came out a couple of weeks ago in the US where they noticed that companies that hire inventors, people who are specifically great at creative ideas and coming up with ideas, whenever they hire these people, they become less inventive and less creative. Because again, you're met with this kind of just that stop and the sort of strategic plan and that kind of thing. So it's just, you know, IT is an interesting thing anyway, but this clash between the sort of the more agile minded IT people with the strategic planning minded corporate people is always an interesting thing. I've seen that in practice a lot.
Well, yeah. Yes, so have I, needless to say.
Mm, I can imagine. Are you an agile proponent, or what's your view?
You know, I have yet to be on a project that was managed on time and under budget ever. And
have you tried pull scheduling instead of push scheduling?
No.
All right. So the difference between the two is push scheduling is when can we have this done? Pull scheduling is within the next quarter, what can we get done? And the difference between the two is that the former is basically plan-based, traditionally plan-based. The latter is more sort of agile and you can do things. And interestingly enough, this is actually how you did things in the early 1900s. If you look at some of the biggest skyscrapers in New York, you'll be amazed at how quickly they were built under budget without a plan. Because if you do pull scheduling, you tend to come in under budget and before time. If you do traditional push scheduling, which is what most companies do, which that's why 70% of all projects fail, then you won't ever come in under budget or on time, basically.
Well, that's the only thing I've experienced. Or no plan at all. I've worked in situations with no plan at all. What I'm working on now is basically, I'm very lucky because I'm not marching to someone else's plan. They knew they needed to meet certain regulatory requirements. So they brought me in a very specific area in the application layer provisioning. That's something I kind of know, like the back of my hand for this particular software. So I came in and I just said, here's what I think you need. And they said, yes, yes, yes. And I'm actively working with the business on making it happen. Now, of course, it is challenging for me because this isn't their core business. They're in business to make a product, ship the product, sell the product, make money. So now I'm trying to get bits of their time to test all these changes. So that's very challenging because it isn't their core business, but they need it in order to meet regulatory requirements or they'll have a problem down the road. So that's the thing that I'm grappling with. The good thing is I don't have a project manager saying, here are the tasks, here's when you have to do it. So that's good. So I can do things well, and they're giving me that flexibility.
Good. I also think if that's a smart company, then they will learn a lot from what you're doing because, and I won't go into complexity because it's a whole field and quite difficult for most. Yeah. But when you're working with complexity in the sense of complex adaptive system, technical complexity, not a higher state of complicatedness, but a completely different thing entirely. What you want to do is you want to run parallel safe to fail experiments. In other words, really cheap experiments and trying stuff out. And then if something works, you give it more research. If it doesn't work, you take away your research. And from what you're describing, being able to try stuff out, if the company is smart, they will see that actually that approach is quite clever, especially when you're working in stuff that isn't part of your core.
Yeah.
Because if you're part of your core, what you do anyway, you tend to know that quite well, mm-hmm. right? So you don't need to run a whole lot of experiments there. Where you need to run experiments is sort of at the edges, because yeah. that stuff is actually what creates survivability over time. But that's a whole different. Now we're getting to strategy and project management, and strategic management, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sure your listeners have, you know, fallen asleep already. So.
We're fluffy. We're fluffy over it, okay. Jules says. Anything else to share?
No, I was going to say, we can go back to the whole male versus female. So I think that's more interesting.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, you have a daughter, you have a wife.
Yes.
You obviously yeah. had a very strong mom. That probably influenced.
Yeah. I mean, yes. But at the same time, you know, I think I said this at my wedding. I think that if I ever grow to be half the man that my dad is, it's twice more than I could ever hope for.
So you had two great parents?
I've been blessed with two great parents. I mean, my dad is just like my hero. He's always supportive. He's always helping out. And, you know, he's very much taught me how to be a man. And within that, I think as well is sort of, you know, that ties into how you treat women as well. A lot of men, I think, are far too preoccupied with how they're perceived. And they want to sort of be macho and, you know, that kind of thing. And oftentimes it's almost like they love the idea of being that macho male more so than they love their wife and whatever else. And at which point I just think you need to get your priorities in order, really. But things like, for example, I took my wife's last name when we got married because it made her happy. And so why wouldn't I do it, right? But at the same time, when I'm out, especially when I'm out in certain parts of the world, like I was doing a couple of talks to Ireland, for example. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I took my wife's last name was just, people were shocked by it.
The first thing, and I don't want to know why, because I'm like, why? I'm asking why, because it is unusual in our culture, in Western culture.
Yeah, I mean, the answer is very, very simple. The reason is the same reason why I make a breakfast every morning and I make a dinner every night. It makes her happy. That's it. My job as her husband is to make her happy. That's it. End of. Being a man is making her happy. And she, you know, she was happy that I took her last name. So I did it. It's not a big thing for me. And it made her happy. I mean, again, that's what it all comes down to. Same thing with my daughter. There's a famous meme almost. There's an image of this sort of really quote unquote traditionally macho man, you know, buff tattoos, the works, walking down the street in a tutu because his daughter's got a tutu, dressed as a fairy, basically. And I've never worn women's clothing in my life or dress or anything like that. And I don't have any intentions to, but if it makes my daughter happy and my daughter, yeah, I'll do it for her. I don't care.
Yeah.
And again, it ties back into that whole how people perceive you. I don't care the only people I care how they perceive me are the people that I love. That's it. And the sort of the perception of strangers, I couldn't give less of a shit about. And
I think that's inner confidence. So many of us just don't have the inner confidence to not give a shit.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. You know, again, that The Last of Us episode, towards the end, there's a letter, and the guy goes, people like you, you and I, referring to the protagonist in this case, he says, people like, or men like you and I, we have a job to do. And what's the line? It is something along the lines of, and God help whatever motherfucker comes in our way, right? And that's the same thing here. Your job, if you want to talk about your job as a sort of a husband or father or whatever else, yes, you have to help provide, not just provide full stop. You know, my wife earns more than I do at the moment. But your job is to support for your family, not just financially, but emotionally and making them happy. And God help any motherfucker that gets in your way.
Touche. Touche. Yeah. I'm interested in the reaction in Ireland.
Well, I mean, people, they were kind of taken aback because no one does that. I mean, Ireland, obviously, quite traditional Catholic country.
Yeah.
And so you don't do that. And my explanation was just like, well, it made her happy, so why wouldn't I? And, you know, I'm not religious, so I don't care about what the Bible might say about it. But then again, I don't care about what anyone else would say about it either. I just care about what my wife would say about it. And so, you know, that's it.
I have no idea if the Bible even says anything about it. I'm also not religious.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I suppose you can interpret all kinds of stuff in the Bible. That's usually the case. But you know, the Catholic faith is very much comes out of, I suppose, it's tied to the Roman Church and sort of Padre Familias and so on. And then you have the strong father and then you take his name, right? Yeah,
the patriarchy.
But, yeah, exactly. And again, you know, I don't, that's a thing as well. It's just, you know, if it makes people happy, then do it. If it doesn't, then don't. Yeah.
Well, that's a lovely thing to end on, unless you have something else you'd like to share.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, it's been my pleasure. I've been ranting on about all kinds of things, but it's been an absolute pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. I hope you come on again. And I especially appreciate that you're willing to do this for free and that I did not tell you to fuck off. Because
a lot of people do that anyway.
If an ethnic minority would like to come on the podcast, you coming on is not going to affect that. There's room for all of us.
Well, thank you. No, I'm happy to come back whenever you want to have it.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. I had to look up that Shakespearean reference to lawyers, and here it is. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. Which at face value may lead you to believe that whoever said this was intended to show that he hated the lawyers. However, this was said by a villainous character named Dick the Butcher. He's a large, threatening murderer, and he's also the right-hand man of a guy who was leading a rebellion against King Henry named Jack. So Dick and Jack are aggressively anti-intellectual in the play. They kill anyone who can read and burn all the books and documents they encounter. Sound familiar? They know that they'll be able to take over an ignorant population with greater ease than one where everyone understands their rights. Apparently, human nature hasn't changed that much since Shakespeare. If you're interested, it is in Henry VI, Part 2, Act 4, Scene 2. Thank you so much for listening. If you have anything you'd like to share, please email me at jewelsays@gmail.com. I'll be back next week.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.